You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. And today I'm talking with Matt Davis from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. And yeah, that sounds like an interesting name for a company. And where this name is coming from and why this company is different from a cultural point of view, we will explore in this episode. So stay tuned. The Effective Statistician Conference is just around the corner. Well, not really, it is in November, but just around the corner is the opportunity for you to present at that conference. So we are already looking for speakers, people that want to create a session, a workshop, or just a poster at the conference. So all you need to do is go to theeffectivestatistician.com, look at the conference page, and there you'll find all the different information. You basically have four different ways how you can help with the content part of the conference. So the first thing what you can do is you can submit a poster. And for that, you submit an abstract following the abstract guidelines that is on the homepage to conference@theeffectivestatistician.com. And this poster and these posters will be presented during the conference in a very, very nice networking environment. So check out the homepage to see High Hive and all what we say about this networking opportunity. The second opportunity that you have is you can present an 18-minute presentation, a pre-recorded presentation, so that you can actually interact with your audience while the presentation is shown. And that will make lots of things easier. To do that, you also need to submit an abstract. Also to conference@theeffectivestatistician.com. The third option is you create a session with a couple of others. And you have the opportunity to make a 60 or a 90-minute session. And you can be pretty free in terms of how you do that. For these sessions, you can do them live or pre-recorded, all kind of different things. And the last opportunity that you have, you can also do a 60 or 90-minute workshop. For that, also tell what you want to do and describe it in an email to conference@theeffectivestatistician and make sure that you mention that you want to run a workshop. And now the best part of it is if you actively contribute to the conference, you will get free access to all the conference material. If you think like, well, I just want to passively attend, that's also fine. You can go to the conference and sign up just for the free part, which will give you limited access, or you sign up to the complete part, and we have a very, very reasonable price for that. That actually increases over time. So check where the price is at the moment. It will increase over time. I love conferences, and as much as I love my conference, there's another conference that is just around the corner. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, and PSI is always organizing an annual conference, which is absolutely outstanding. It shows that they really create a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. So this year, the conference is in Amsterdam. And as you listen to this, it's just 2 weeks away from there. If you still can do it, awesome. It will be great. I'll meet you there and we can have a beer or coffee, whatever the time of the day is, and can chat with each other. You will also become a PSI member by registering to this conference. If you want to just become a PSI member without coming to the conference, that's also great. You can get lots of additional learnings. So you can find out about the conference and all the other great things PSI is doing at psiweb.org. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. And today I'm super happy to talk with Matt Davis from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. When I first learned about Jazz Pharmaceuticals, I thought about Jazz. That's an interesting name for a pharma company, but we'll touch based on that a little bit later. So first, over to you, Matt. Maybe you can introduce yourself to the listener.
Absolutely, Alexander. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here, so I'm excited to be able to talk to you. My name is Matt. I run the data science organization here at Jazz Pharmaceuticals. I've had kind of an interesting career journey to get here. I actually started off my career as a middle school math teacher. So I used to teach 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. So 12 through 14-year-olds were my sweet spot. And did that for a couple years, decided that I wanted to leave and get into the pharmaceutical industry because I was getting my master's in applied statistics at the time. Ended up working at a CRO for about 7 years when I realized how much I love this job, but I did not really enjoy the consulting side of it. I preferred at the time to be on the pharma side. And the only way I knew how to do that was to go get my PhD. So I got my PhD in biostatistics from UPenn at the same time as I worked full-time. So I did school full-time and worked full-time, which was a nightmare and why you see all this gray hair on my head. And I finished that up. I got hired as an individual contributor at Teva Pharmaceuticals. And in a span of a number of years, went from a statistician to a therapeutic area head, to the head of statistics, to the head of biometrics at Teva, before leaving there to join a small company called GW Pharmaceuticals. GW was acquired by Jazz, and I was named as the head of biometrics at Jazz about 3 years ago, and then became the head of data science now. And just because data science means different things to different people, we're responsible for bioinformatics, clinical statistics, statistical programming, medical affairs and value statistics, real world evidence, and pharmacoepidemiology. So that's the background, and that's the team.
That is pretty awesome that you have all these quantitative scientists all together, which in many other companies work quite isolated from each other and sometimes more against each other than together.
I would share that's one of the hardest parts that I've noticed even in previous jobs is when you have so many quantitative individuals that aren't actually working together, it's actually a huge disaster and nightmare. You might have two or three different quantitative groups working on the exact same problem, but they do it using different definitions and they all get an answer that's conflicting and then nobody knows who to believe. And it's not very efficient. So we're trying to solve that by harmonizing them under one shot.
Yeah, I've seen that before in companies and where then kind of the different departments had kind of fight each other so that, well, my method is wrong and is right and yours is wrong and you should only believe me but not these guys over there, and which of course kind of doesn't help anybody. So that is actually very closely related to the topic that we want to talk about today. I recently stepped over an article on LinkedIn that you also highlighted. It is a Forbes article by your CEO about Jazz culture.
Yep.
And I read it with a lot of interest because there's a lot of talking about culture and creating culture. And in the end, very often culture is a product of decades of hiring, firing, and all kind of other decisions that happen within the company. And for Jazz, that's a little bit different. Can you tell us a little bit about how Jazz got its culture and why that is so important for the company?
Yeah, so I'll start by saying, you know, I respect and admire Bruce Cozadd, our CEO, very much. He says that he started this company based on culture, that he wanted to have a company that was culture first. And he is a man that has lived up to that aspiration. I've gotten a chance to observe him publicly and privately and can tell you that this is a man that walks that walk, which I've seen other people that can't, and he can, and it permeates itself through all of the organization. I'll just give an example of how that comes. I mean, the Forbes article kind of walks through a number of the things that he thinks are important in the culture, which admittedly is putting patients first. Our purpose as is to innovate to transform the lives of patients and their families. I've memorized that because it's central to everything that we do. But they also talking about wanting to make jazz the best experience of the career of every jazzician, which is what we affectionately refer to as anyone that works at jazz. Yeah. But there was actually a story a couple of years ago. I actually applied for a job at Jazz before my career led me here. And in the application process, they sent another article that Bruce had written for another magazine a couple of years ago. And it outlined his expectations in the culture. And basically, right up front, they said, if your values don't align with this publication, this probably isn't the job for you, because we're a culture first company. And I was blown away by that, especially walking out of a culture that I didn't love. To say that it was culture first was just transformative in terms of how I thought of a workplace.
Yeah. And I think it's really, really interesting to have both the employee focus and the patient focused in it. Most companies, especially the bigger ones, focus first on the shareholders.
Yep.
And talk mostly about them. Of course, they also talk about the patients, but when push comes to shoals, it's usually let's sell our drugs.
That's right.
And so what really kind of stood out for me is that he was, for example, speaking about the role of the sales representatives, and that their role is predominantly to be educators.
Yep.
And help the physicians they support, the HCPs, the kind of typical pharma abbreviation, to make the right decisions, not to just, you know, prescribe our drug.
Yep.
And I think this is really very much aligned with what my vision is, to provide the right evidence at the right time to make the right decision. And how does that reflect with your organization that supports also data for that?
Yeah, well, I think that it's kind of like the shining beacon that we all work towards, right? And it's a filter that we view every problem that we come against is what is best for the patient at the end of the day. And as data scientists, statisticians, programmers, the whole umbrella, I think we're faced with a lot of those problems often, especially if you're in the more medical affairs value side of things, because you know that when you're trying to present data, you're trying to interpret a clinical trial, you can interpret it through a lot of different lenses. You can interpret it through the lens of what's best for the company, what's best for yourself, what's best for the product, or what's best for patients. And you can tell different stories based off of that. And we live this mantra right up front that says we do what's best for the patients. And if that means that we interpret a post-hoc analysis or a clinical trial readout or a real-world evidence study as not being favorable to us, but it's very informative to the patient, that's really important for us to strongly consider because it's patient first. And I'd say the other side of that, maybe sometimes you know that there's always a temptation for us as data scientists to put that little spin or just that little extra piece of the analysis that would make it more favorable to us to get that p-value under 0.05, for example, when we know that's not the best way to do it. We don't do that because it's not what's best for the patients. And so I think at least as much as we can try to do that, it really makes us just view all of our data outputs and communication about our data as being patient focused first.
That's a pretty cool thing about it, because I know that lots of people, especially statisticians in that space, very much love that perspective, yet still struggle very often to fight against company internal culture. Although, of course, the official policies always say that our publications are well balanced and so on. Yeah.
Yep.
So speaking about it and doing it are two very, very different things. So how does that kind of materialize in the everyday doing? Can you give an example?
So So a couple things. I mean, the biggest example I can give is not that I can give a whole lot of specifics about it, but being in higher level governance situations where you're discussing one of these different outputs, and there's a lot of opinions around the table on what we should and what we should do with it. And then having the voice of Bruce or somebody else that steps up and says, hey, everyone, we are here to do what's right for the patients first. So how do we make this decision in terms of what's right for the patients first? And I think that's what's so unique here. It's as soon as that sentiment comes out, as we're debating on what to do with this, it kind of reshapes everyone's focus. And I think because we all believe this so much in our hearts, you know, sometimes even if your head isn't in the right space while you're making that decision, as soon as someone says that, you're like, oh, yeah, right, of course. Yeah. Patient first. Let's focus on patient first. And I think it's just the common vocabulary, vernacular, and also shared values that say that that should be the guiding light for our decision-making process. So that's one way that I see it.
Yeah, I think that is actually a very, very powerful way. If people always speak up when things don't go along with this culture, and they are acknowledged, and then everybody appreciates it and comes back on the ship, that is really, really important. Yeah, that actually, I think, makes a big difference. Yeah, because there's always going to be someone that, you know, violates, goes off track, you know, comes from another company, doesn't know the culture yet, has been measured differently.
Yeah, and it's also interesting when that happens. I think the other way that you can determine how well a company is doing with this is what happens in those situations, right? Is it just swept under the rug? It's like, oh, that's just how this person operates, or is there something really done about it? Do people really care? Does compliance step in? Are there other ways that happens? And it's like the other side of that coin. It's so when invariably there's a bad actor or something like that happens, what does the company do to help fix that culture? And I think that speaks volumes on the other side as well, because we all know that's going to happen at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think unfortunately, we all have these kind of compliance departments, but the more you don't need them,
yes, that's
the
right.
Better. Yeah. So it's kind of if people within the teams directly correct it, and don't kind of call the compliance number anonymously, that is a much, much better way and more powerful way to correct it.
Yeah, because if you really think about what that means from a cultural perspective, I mean, we want to build a culture where people feel safe to speak up, that they have the right relationships, that they have the autonomy within their teams to be able to solve their problems and self-correct, so to speak. And when you have team members that respect each other enough to do that with one another, there's not a whole lot of compliance phone calls in that case, because you're actually able to solve it person on person and be more autonomous to be successful, which is some of the things that we strive to do.
Yeah, and I think that is a great fundamental thing for you to also have a place where people strive. This psychological safety is so important for all the different things that we do. Yeah, to speak up when there is a weird signal in the safety data, or when there's a certain part of the population that looks like they get more harms than benefit from the drug, or all these kind of different things, or there's conflicting data, that people can bring that up irrespective of where they come from and so on. That makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. There's something that I learned when I was teaching that I use a lot as I think about setting the culture and leadership and everything, at least what we try to do for our team. And that's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't know if you ever heard of this before, but you know, that concept of, if for anyone that isn't familiar with this, it's a gentleman named Maslow that put this out as terms of like, what do you need for somebody to actually be their best self? And we used it in teaching when you have a child that wasn't performing at their best. It was like, why wouldn't they be performing at their best? And the very lowest level of the hierarchy of needs is your physiological needs. Like, you can't expect a child to do well on a math test if they don't have somewhere to sleep at night, or if they don't have somewhere to eat. Like, that's not a fair thing for them to expect. I think the same thing happens at work. I mean, you've got the physiological needs, which many of our people have that covered just due to the nature of the industry we work in. But then you build off of that safety needs, which is where that psychological safety comes in, right? It's like, if I don't feel safe to be able to speak up or talk to another employee or be able to work something out within my team, I'm never going to be successful and be innovative and speak up about the safety signal. And then you build on that love and belonging and then esteem. And then at the very top, after safety, love, belonging, esteem, is the ability to innovate. And you can never expect people to truly innovate unless you're building the whole pyramid up, right? Yep. And so that's where, like you mentioned, trying to really be intentional about how we're building the culture by making people feel cared for, supported, belonging, that they have all the tools they need, they have the support from us as management. Now you go and change the world. And I think that's how we really can build a culture that supports this purpose of innovating.
Yeah, innovation is also mentioned quite a lot in this Forbes article. And your CEO speaks about taking risks and learning quickly from failure so that you can move forward and have success. How does that work within your organization when it comes to learning from failure, learning from data, learning from evidence? How does that, you know, help you to make better decisions about your pipeline?
Yeah. So one of the things I love about Jazz is the size of the company it is. I think at this point, Jazz is somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 employees, and it's well-funded. So I think the good part about that is that we have the ability and the resources to do a lot of exciting things, but it's not so big that it's this huge ship that we have to be able to steer. So I think one of the ways that we do that is by maintaining agility, not only in our programs, but in all of the different ways that we work. So for example, you know, there's this concept of double-blind sponsor open studies. I don't know if you're, how familiar we are with those, but it's where we try to keep a blinding at the site and the investigator, but then we at Jazz keep a number of internal people unblinded to it, like in a phase one or a phase 2A study. So we might be able to look at the data more often and make a decision about where we want to go. At other companies, that concept might take years to be able to come up and running. And how do we get that straightened out? At Jazz, I think it took us about 2 months to be able to say, yes, that fits right in with what we want to do. We want to make these decisions as we go. Let's make it happen. So I think that it's a company that just maintains agility at its core to look at data on an ongoing basis in obviously scientifically rigorous, compliant ways, but that is not afraid to pivot from a strategy when it makes the most sense for the compound.
So agility for you means making decisions fast, sticking to it, and then reevaluating as you get more data.
Yeah, I think the biggest focus is the speed of data and the speed of decision making. The sticking to the decisions is always something that we're continuing to grow in. But I think definitely the speed and how we make the decisions is really important, which lets us to not only progress our compounds the fastest, but also allocate our resources to different things. Because obviously we're not, you know, while we have a lot of resources, they're not infinite. So in some cases, a decision on one program means that we have to shift our resources toward a completely different program. That's something we're doing well now and able to shift things across as needed. And the only way to do it is through these more rapid decision-making processes that the data scientists actually are leaned on quite heavily to make sure it has that rigor and has the right information that's interpreted correctly so we can make those larger portfolio decisions.
So that's really interesting. What I know from lots of other companies that to make a decision, you usually go through many different layers of governance.
Yeah.
How does it work at Jazz?
We have two layers of governance. So that's your answer. So we have a layer of governance that focuses more on the portfolio level of governance in terms of what are the large decisions that we need to make for this compound. Think, how should we spend $50 million or $100 million on this compound? Should we go after this large indication or a smaller indication? So a governance level that handles that piece, and then a governance level that's more tactical, more clinical development, R&D focused governance level of how much money should we spend on each project? Should this project move forward? Is option A better than option B? If we stopped this product, where would we move that money towards? And those are your two governance levels that would monitor those types of decisions.
Okay, that's pretty cool. So when you make these decisions, of course you have your internal compounds, but of course externally also a lot happens.
Yes.
And in your CEO talks about, well, you want to move forward with the best molecule for the patients. So what do you do if you have if you see that there's an external molecule that's actually much better than yours?
Yeah, and that is something we evaluate often, not only from a patient benefit perspective, but also from a commercial perspective. I think one of the things that's important to remember is that when you're early in clinical development, just because something looks better than your molecule doesn't mean that it actually is better than your molecule, right? So yeah. I think there's that element to it. But even if you have a molecule that makes it out to market that might not be as good as another one in some area, a lot of times it might be better in some other area. Like maybe it's not as efficacious, but we have a more convenient dosing schedule. Or maybe it's picked up by more providers, so more patients have access to it. Or maybe we're approved in a different country that the other one's not approved in. So I think it's hard to say that you ever have a molecule that is just flat out worse than another molecule. It's usually the benefits and trade-offs of what this means to individual patients and making sure that we can confidently say for some element of this molecule that there's real patient benefit to this.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a very, very important point. What is a patient benefit very often depends on the preferences the patients have. And of course, also the choices the patient has.
It really does, doesn't it? And those aren't always the easiest to quantify. You know, I think that's where the whole realm of like patient-centered outcomes and patient-focused drug development is moving towards, is what we think or what the prescribers think or what the payers think is important about this specific disease to cure might not be the same as what the patients actually think. And sometimes you get a patient involved and they think very differently. Hey, you know, yeah, you're focusing on caregiver impression scales and PROs, but all I want to be able to do is eat my breakfast. Yeah. You know, like that level of thing, or get dressed in the morning. So I think it's so important that we keep the holistic perspective of what the patients really need and making sure that we're actually addressing those areas.
So if you compare internal to external innovations, how do you do that actually from a technical point of view?
From a data science perspective?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, again, I think is, if we're staying on the focus of culture and innovation, this is something that I'm really proud of our team for. And so I'm going to take a minute to brag about the group. Our team's awesome. And I'm so proud of everybody in our team, but we have a group of people that really do care for and respect each other. And I think that, so if we're talking about that kind of pyramid of needs, I think for most people, not everyone, and I'm sure I was thinking about this lining up to the podcast, like I'm sure someone's going to listen to this and say like, that was not my experience at all. And that happens with some people, but we try. So we try to build that layer of respect and care and belonging for individuals. But then when it comes to the innovation element, you know, one of the things that we pushed really hard from a stats perspective a couple of years ago was making sure that everybody was at minimum conversant with Bayesian statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you have to be able to at least talk about it and know it. But then I created a complex innovative drug development course, or complex innovative design course, that I got a chance to walk everybody and our team through not only Bayesian statistics, but the most cutting edge, like master protocols and like biomarker driven drug development and things. And we actually got invited to the complex innovative design program from the FDA and got to participate in that, which was really exciting. But the innovation comes now is that now that's part of the culture. So now everybody is expected to not only do this, but our clinical development teams are now expecting that of us. So it just kind of happens naturally that you start talking to people about it and you teach them it and they get it and then they practice it and then they can do it. But the way I like to do things like that is also combine it with the right partners externally that are the experts in this. So if you have a consultant that is an expert in complex innovative study design, for example, we partner with them to do a couple projects with the hopes that those statisticians that are partnering with them can then eventually do it on their own, et cetera. I think the answer to your question is we expect our people to do this, but we teach them how to do it, right? So you don't have to do it on day one, but maybe by 6 months that you'll know enough, you'll have the right money, you'll have the right partner to do it, and then you can really take off from there to do it on your own.
I love the way how you kind of introduced it by teaching it to your colleagues, by getting the external support with the FDA and all these kind of different things. This is exactly what I talk about when I speak about change management. Yeah, you need to have resources that the regulators are on top of it, that they agree with it. You need to make sure that the people that you talk to actually understand what you talk about. And you can't just think, well, they have a MD or they have a, you know, high degree. No, you know, all these things that are, you know, not even standard for statisticians definitely are not standard for the non-statisticians. And so if they see something new, they will not believe you if you don't explain it to them.
No, they don't. And I think that's, you know, when we struggle, I think, just as much as anybody else does, even with our great culture of getting the right seat at the table and being included in the right decisions. And that's something I know a lot of groups struggle with. We struggle with that too. But I do tell the team members, like, when you can do something that your partners cannot do and they know they can't do it, just watch how fast it takes off, especially if it has a real benefit to them.
Yeah.
When you talk about a Bayesian study design where you're doing an interim every month, for example, your first clinical development lead will look at you and say, that's actually not possible. And you're like, I know it is possible, but let me walk you through it. And then the next time you work together, they're the first ones that come to you and says, hey, we need one of those Bayesian designs like now, because otherwise we're not going to be successful. It becomes the norm. And it's amazing when you show something they feel like they can't do, all of a sudden it just catapults your status within the company and your ability to be influential.
Yeah. And you talked about, you explain it in their benefits.
That's right. Yeah?
So
that's right.
That is a real big part. It's not about, oh, I want to do this fancy statistics and I want to kind of stand out and have, you know, present at stats conference about all the cool things that I did. That is not convincing to your regulatory or your clinical counterpart. They want to know, will the FDA like it? Is it possible? Has it been done before? Can I trust you? Can I actually understand it? Or will I look stupid when I explain it to someone else?
Right. You know, I think I was listening to one of your recent podcasts on the open source transition from SaaS to R, or how those relate. And, you know, this fits right in with that concept as well. So our programming team has started to develop a lot of shiny apps that are used for our tables, listings, and figures. Actually, what my hope is that we kind of get away from TFLs altogether.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just do shiny apps, because I prefer to look at figures than anything else. But it was amazing. If I told our clinical colleagues, hey, we're going to do this app in replace of TFLs, they would have never bought into it until we showed them the app. And we're like, okay, here you go. Here's the app. Why don't you guys go play around and look at all your information? And they've come back to us now and said, can we not have tables anymore? Can we just have the app? And it's amazing. But but we had to show them the value. And again, it's just what you said before, is you have to show them in whatever way you can what value this innovation is going to create. Because once you convince them, you'll never go back. It just flips them 100%, so they know, yeah, you were right the whole time. And it's just amazing when you have the ability to be able to do things like that. But the hard part, just, you can't let them drive it all the time either, right? A lot of times we know what's best for these innovations and we have to push it a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think any clinical development lead or medical affairs lead would ask us for a shiny app specifically that lets them explore subgroups. But when we give it to them, they say, thank you so much. This is exactly what I've been looking for. So it's just another area for us as data scientists to lead holistically when we're really that value innovation driven.
Absolutely. Well, they will not ask for anything that they don't even know exists or
That's
is
right.
possible. Yeah. So nobody asks Steve Jobs to create the iPhone. Yeah. When there's kind of this quote about Ford that if he would have listened to customers, he would have made faster horses. Yeah. But that's right. that's not the point. Yeah.
Yeah. So, their idea of innovation was, you know, I know what you want and I'm going to show you what you want. You don't always need to ask you what you want. And it's a tricky balance, I know. But like you said, with the iPhone perspective, like, here, let me show you what you're going to love. And they did. And I think as data science grows faster and faster and we have more capabilities, we're probably going to be more in that second camp of let me show you what you're going to love. And you're going to really change your perspective on things.
Yeah. And don't only rely on your internal knowledge. Yeah. Look for the external experts that you can bring in and help with it. Yeah, I think that is that's another great feature of culture, of this kind of being humble that we don't know everything. There's other companies that have this. If it's not invented here, then it's not worth it. Yeah, and that is a very, very bad thing, I would say.
Yeah, I want to talk about that for a minute because I see that. I see that in my team members. I see it in a lot of different groups, is this fear of saying that you can't do something or for asking for help, right? Like, we have to, as data scientists, get over that fear and to be able to be in a supportive environment where you can go to your manager or to somebody else and say, hey, I don't know how to do this. And either I need to learn how to do it or we could benefit better from going externally. Yeah. I've seen data scientists, I don't know if you've seen this, that would rather like miss a timeline or not share that there's any issue just because they didn't want to speak up and say I was having a problem. And it's going to kill innovation, not to mention erode trust and be not a great place to work for them and their teammates, et cetera. But what you're saying about the external innovations, I mean, we, as data scientists, I think a lot of times we want to do cool stuff. Right? We are good at coding, we're good at programming, we're good at mathematics, we're good at stats, we want to do it. But you have to realize that there are a lot of people that do these types of things for a full-time job that are completely invested, that you could tap them for a couple hours, their expertise, and catapult you hundreds and hundreds of hours of work. And you can't be afraid of that. You have to embrace that. And it's going to make you move so much faster and be more innovative.
Yeah. And you just talked about the speed and the money side. Yeah. It may take you quite a long time. Yeah. A lot of your time to get better at it. And just by working with someone else, you learn it from the best and then you move so much faster. Exactly. Yeah.
It's true. Like, I hate to break it to everyone, but like, you, at the end of the day, you are actually an expense as well, right? So if it takes you 3 or 4 months to do something, that's still money you're paying to do it. Not to mention, I think sometimes what we don't think about is we don't think about like the lost opportunity cost of something, right? If you can get something 3 months faster and you can make faster decisions, you know, we're putting together an advanced analytics and AI strategy for R&D right now. And we've got 4 value drivers on this. So this has taken me about 2 years to figure out what our 4 value drivers are. But the 4 value drivers for our strategy are increased number of shots on goal in our pipeline, increased probability of success for our compounds, increased profitability for the company. And the 4th, which is very jazz focused, is the best experience for patients, providers, and employees. Mm-hmm. And anything that we can do from advanced analytics and AI that helps any 4 of those values is considered like valuable in our book, right? And so I think that as we're thinking about where we can innovate these, like getting things done faster, if you can get a faster probability of success, the ENPV of your portfolio goes up, your company is more valuable externally, you have more shots on goal in the pipeline, you can say that externally, like, you don't want to wait 3 months for those. You need those now. So if you need help with that, like, push it to happen now, because the entire company and your patients will actually benefit from that.
Yeah. Love it. That is a great summary. And maybe at some point we need to talk about this strategies that you have put together, because these 4 drivers sound really, really interesting. So we talked about the corporate culture and that Jazz was founded with having this culture first in mind and build the company around the culture. And by the way, Jazz is just 20 years old. Yeah. So it's not a, you know, Eli Lilly or Merck or whatever that are hundreds of years old. Yeah, it's quite a new company. And therefore, I think this is really, really interesting with the speed at which it has grown and really build it on this culture of patient first, employees, making sure that employees are happy, and how that translates into all these different decisions that you make, like from hiring the right people, what kind of successes do you celebrate, what do you talk about in company meetings, what do you measure success in, all these kind of different things are in the end really culture. And I love that you talked up about this or talked about this example where someone, you know, spoke up in a important key decision meeting to say, let's make those decisions that are best for the patients.
Right.
So what is your key takeaway for the listener from this episode?
I think the key takeaway that I would encourage you all is to evaluate the culture that you're in and how that aligns to your values as an individual. For me, why I went from education to healthcare is because I want to be in a job that helps people. Mm. And at its core, that's why, you know, I don't choose to go into finance. I don't choose to go into sports as much as I think sports would be really cool to go into. I don't do that because I want what my job is at the end of the day to really matter in the world and matter for people. And because Jazz has a culture that innovates to transform the lives of patients and their families, I know that the work that I do meets the values of the company and my values. And I think the biggest takeaway I would say is evaluate where you are in terms of how your work and how your work culture marries with your personal values and see what you can do to make it a more patient-focused culture. I think the more people that step up and say, let's do what's right for the patients, the better the whole industry is going to be and the more patients that are going to benefit. So that would be my takeaway for all of you.
Love it. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Alexander.
I hope you enjoyed the discussion with Matt as much as I did. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to check out the Effective Decision Conference, and I would love for you to actively contribute there. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.